Magnified with Matt Cooper. Proudly sponsored by Close Brothers Motor Finance. Recognised on Trustpilot as best in class in Ireland. With fast, fair finance decisions. Made in minutes, sometimes seconds. Motor dealerships and brokers. Looking to become a partner? Get in touch at closemotorfinance.ie.
Go loud. Sounds better with us.
Hello and welcome to this latest edition of Magnified with Matt Cooper, the interview series brought to you by Close Brothers Motor Finance. Today's guest is a man who was a great GAA star in Galway, and with his clubs, he was a winner of All-Ireland Senior Football Medal with Galway in 2001, lost a couple of All-Ireland Hurling Finals the same year in 2005. He also then won club championships with Salt Hill in the football and with his native Clarence Bridge in hurling. Alan Kearns, though, is better known perhaps to many people for the work that he has done in fundraising for charitable work in Africa. Over 10 million euro has been raised by him and his associates over the course of the last two decades. And in this podcast, we talk about why he got involved so much in Africa, his experiences there, his time in the GAA, and also the illness that for his young son Ruan experienced after he was born, and how he and his wife Kira got through that. So there's an enormous amount in this interview with Alan Kearns. This series of Magnified is brought to you by Close Brothers Motor Finance, which is recognised on Trustpilot as best in class in Ireland with fast, fair finance decisions made in minutes, sometimes seconds. Motor dealerships and brokers looking to become a partner, reach out to the team at closemotorfinance.ie. Anyway, here is our interview with Alan Kearns. Alan Kearns, thank you very much for joining me for this latest edition of Magnified. I thought it would be good to start the year to talk to somebody who has been very involved in charity for decades. To also maybe perhaps talk about, you know, we give out in Ireland an awful lot about the things that we don't have. But it strikes me from having spoken to you in the past and having last year being at a self-help Africa function that sometimes we don't realise just how little many other people in the world actually have. So I thought it might be a good time to actually talk about what others are missing while we have, by comparison, a relatively good lifestyle. Or is that an unfair way to start things?
I suppose there's two ways you can look at it. Yeah. I'm just back in a recent trip in November where we brought 40 GAA stars, our third ever Plant the Planet Games, and all the players raised 10 grand. And collectively, we left a great legacy, I suppose, of planting 1 million trees, but more importantly, hundreds of thousands of families will live off those trees long after the players and myself are gone.
Yeah.
Because the trees we plant are food crops and cash crops and shelter belts and reforestation and rehabilitation of degraded soil, etc. So there's multiple benefits, not just to the environment, but to creating many, many sustainable livelihoods, communities and schools. And the players will often come back from that trip and be blown away by how little these people have that we meet and connect on a human level. And you often feel when people connect on a human level, great barriers are broken down and magic happens. And great friendships are formed and great respect. And they would say, and I would say from my 20 years of experience in Africa, that I've learned an awful lot more from the African people and their resilience and their creativity and their sharing and the village to raise a child, etc., etc. And how happy they are we've so much more than them materially, but maybe mentally or emotionally or resilience or community, we may have a lot less. And they're often blown away by their smiles and the freedom the kids have over there and the happiness that they exude and the dance. They're not afraid of people's opinions. They just dance. When we go into a community, they'll welcome us with song and dance. And our guys are so stiff. But by the end of the week, they don't care what people think about them. And we're so trapped in prison by what people think of us and people's judgment of us and society's judgment and maybe social media's judgment of us. And they don't have that. So, yes, while they have very harsh lives, the basics of food, water, education, opportunity, they have probably a greater freedom in what I've just talked about there.
There's so much that I want to unpack out of all of that. There's so many angles. Just on a practical angle, though, come back and explain a little bit more about the benefit of planting trees.
Yeah, and I suppose, I think we're going to get away from planting trees because it's become negative. Not negative, but people are maybe sick of hearing people planting trees, but just as a do-gooder or it's a debate about climate change. But trees are amazing, in particularly all over the world, but particularly in Africa, because I suppose these communities have contributed least to climate change but are affected most by it. In some areas we visit, like Baringo, that may have not rained for the last 4 or 5 years, you know. So each area we go to, for example, we went to a school, and the school has, you know, hundreds of children, and they had a terrace and they grew their crops there. But often if they get heavy rain, the crop be washed away. So in that area, we planted 4 trees.
And this is what you mean by a shelter belt?
Yeah. So what we did here is they had loads of crops, tomatoes and cassava and maize and whatever other crops they were planting in the area. But this particular project that we were funding to the players was we planted 2 trees that had huge roots. So those roots would grow deep into the soil and knit together and tie together, but they would stabilise the soil to prevent it from
some
landslides and stuff like that subsiding, yeah. And then the other crop we planted was avocado, which is nutrient-rich, but also very cash-rich. So they would be nutrient-rich for the children, you know, for their education and their brain development, but also cash-rich, where they would be trained and educated to sell the surplus to generate cash. And that cash would be used to school fees or school uniforms, whatever the children may need in the area, or house them. And then the last crop was a tree with massive leaves, and when the leaves fall, they gather together and they compost, and then they improve the soil quality and the nutrients in the soil. So it's amazing how what that can do for an area. But more, I suppose the wider area, we say the benefits of the trees are their cash crops that are planted, their food crops that are planted. There's shelter belts, there's rehabilitation of greater soil, there's nitrogen-rich crops, reforestation. But most importantly, the communities and the families that get the trees will own them. And then they're trained and educated and given technical support to live off them. With True Self of Africa and the work to do on the ground and their local teams and local co-ops and local partnerships. And they're also growing nurseries. And that's the most important bit, because when they own them and they represent a sustainable livelihood, they're far more likely to look after them.
When you say about owning them as well, because there is sometimes a bit of a kickback about white saviours, white people who previously had colonialised Africa, going in and now another generation saying, we'll tell you how to do it and we'll set this all up for you. So how do you avoid that?
Well, all the Self of Baffer team are all locals. There's no expats. All the country directors, all the programme officers are all locals, or Kenyans or Zambians or Tanzanians or whatever. And
so what's the role then of the Irish people going out there?
The Irish people going out, for us?
Yeah.
For the matches that we go out to do?
Well, no, just even like in...
I suppose supply, to just help support, monitor, funding.
These are the things that they want, and you help supply the finance for it.
It's all about a hand up, not a handout. And it's all about empowering them to do it themselves rather than us doing. Like, for example, years ago I learned that lesson where we used to bring people out to build houses, and then one guy said to me, why are you building there? He said, would these people build their own house? And I said, no, probably not. Well, then why are they good enough to build these people's houses? So we changed our model totally, where we partnered with another NGO in Zambia, and they would bring in, they were a construction NGO, build it based in the UK, but they would bring in Zambian project managers, and then they would interview 40, 50 people in the area and bring them on as people who are interested in learning a trade, and then they'd bring them on as trainees and educate them in the during the build on practical and theory. And at the end of the build, then if they did an exam, if they passed that, they get a nationally recognised cert and get a toolbox. So now they're a skilled labourer. So we built a multi-purpose centre in Kioma. The next build we did was a school, and you know, this guy called Aaron was hired as an employee on the project after being a trainee. And the next build, he became a supervisor. And the next build, he was his own little contractor, so we gave him a small ablution block, and now he's a successful builder with a load of local employees. So you're also in that model, you're creating positive role models, and you're trying to break that, what you're talking about, the white saviors. You're breaking, well, if Aaron can do it, I can do it. So if you can create positive role models of locals doing it, it's far better. And another model we did, you know, I went in this as a novice. I didn't intend to set up a charity, so I was learning on the job. And, you know, we changed our model to, you know, social enterprises. So I was working with this Irish nun who ran the home for disabled children. And, you know, she was trying to generate money locally, or she's always depending on donors. So how do we make her donor independent from donor dependency? So we ended up identifying through 2 or 3 great businessmen that supported me, that there's a big need for accommodation in this town, and there's a big need for good building materials because they were quite poor. You had to go 800 kilometres to Lusaka for the materials, and that cost huge money transporting it out. So we developed a block making project with her, a very successful one, and we developed a 40, 50 bedroom lodge and a 100 seater restaurant. And now it's all and trained extensively the locals to run it. So you're creating 2 businesses that the Cheshire Home owned, and now those 2 businesses are creating loads of jobs locally. They're generating a lot of money locally that goes back into running the home for disabled children, goes back into schools, and goes back into housing programs. So you're trying to create a replicable model that you can transfer to different areas where they're generating the money locally rather than depending on us now.
I love that line that you go back to when you said there a few minutes ago about somebody turning around and saying to you, do these people that you've brought out here to build homes, do they build houses themselves back in Ireland? Yeah. Because that was a sort of, there was a phase where everyone, phase, you know, sort of like lots of people between sports stars, business people, whatever, going out with all the best intentions in the world and wanting to do good. But at the same time, did they actually necessarily have the skills to be doing? That must have been one of, I think you've had quite a few eureka moments, haven't you?
When
things have happened, you suddenly, and you're, oh, right, okay, we need to do things differently.
And you need to learn from the experts, and you need to learn from, listen to the people as well. You don't go in and just tell them. You have to listen and work with them on what they need. Because we might think they need this, but they don't. They might need this, and it's all about working in collaboration and listening and respecting the locals, and the big thing is supporting them to do it for themselves if you can, because that's the most, it's longer, it's more painful, but it's ultimately the most effective way of creating that community development.
But yet, at the same time, I don't want in any way to sound critical of those who went and did building or have done other things, because it has to be for the good of so many people, particularly in the GAA, that they have become involved with you over the last 20 years. I mean, at this stage, you must have had hundreds of GAA players have gone to Africa with you.
Well, in the Planet Games we've had in the last 3 years, 140 probably players who raised maybe 1.5 million. And I suppose the Planet Games is different because...
What's the Planet Games? Explain what's involved in that.
Yes, and I suppose my new movement, Warriors for Humanity, I'm a big believer that most people want to make a difference. But life, they don't know how to, or life gets in the way. And I suppose Warriors for Humanity will hopefully become a global platform where we give people unique opportunities and unique experiences to come on board and leave a positive legacy and make a positive impact before they go. I think most people want to do that. Not everybody, but most people. As I said, life gets in the way, life's too busy. So Plant the Planet Games is exactly that, where we want to give them an extraordinary experience that gives them extraordinary memories, that allows them to leave an extraordinary impact and thus an extraordinary legacy. So Plant the Planet Games was combining my 2 passions, I suppose, of GAA and Africa. So I'd always a dream of bringing an inter-county team or an inter-county game or an all-star match to Africa, first ever. So in 2020, we decided to do it, but COVID hit, so it was 2022. So I got 50 GAA players, male and female. It was the first ever 4-quarter trip as well. So it was kind of building on and help promoting the kind of inclusivity.
So just for non-GAA people, Gaelic football, ladies football, camogie and hurling.
So it representative of all those 4 codes, high profile to low profile, stronger counties to weaker counties, did make a difference. It was a lovely group, huge group. And the idea was that we want to become the first sports to plant 1 million trees as a collective. And we didn't plan. We didn't go out and do the work. We went out. It was symbolic. Yeah. And it was also to use sport and music as a tool, or to demonstrate how sport and music could be a real positive tool to unite different cultures. And was going out and not a white savers as equal, where we connected with the locals on where we shared culture, we shared music, we shared sport, and we shared dance. And when you do that at a human, when you connect people on a human level, it breaks down all barriers. I think that's the great foundation for creating unified societies going forward, especially. And you can see with the great work Graham Clifford does with Sanctuary Runners, where people run together. And with the people,
these are the immigrants to Ireland,
yeah,
and, who have bonded
and,
together,
and the great and job opportunities come, and relations come, and friendships come. So, sorry, I'm rambling, but ultimately, Plant the Planet Games was to become the first ever intercounty game in All Star game in Africa. Kenya became the country. It was they all raised 10 grand, enough money to plant 1 million trees as a collective for the environment, but also, as I said, to create every tree represents a sustainable livelihood. And then we also did cultural experiences, and we also met Brother Colin McConnell, and we ran with these wonderful Kenyan athletes.
Sorry, this is the Cork-born brother, isn't it, Mallow, who has been living in Africa for how many, 60 years now at this stage?
Since 70, early 70s.
Yeah, so we are talking 50 years
50
plus.
50 years, yeah.
And he trained some of the brilliant...
50 years next year, actually.
Is that it?
Yeah.
And he's trained some of the great Olympic athletes.
He has seven Olympic champions and some like 35 world champions that's gone through. He sent Patsy 10 and youth program, and he went down with the great David Rudisha as his coach in London and in Rio, where he broke the 800, one of the greatest performances in Olympic history, that 800 metre gun to tape Olympic record for 800 metres. So he's trained Wilson, Kipketer, Sally Bersosio, you know, Rose Chariot, Peter Rono, Matthew Barrera, all these, and we've met them, and they've come and shared their experiences with the athletes, and the athletes really love that, and running at altitude and running with the Kenyans and seeing how light they are on their feet and seeing how graceful they are, and I suppose the challenge of running at altitude as well for them as well. It's a great experience for them in terms of the high performance element of their sport.
Okay, eureka moments. Go back and tell me how your interest in Africa was piqued as a child by Live Aid.
I was 7 years of age, give me away my age, in 1984. And I remember watching the news on TV at home, and I remember watching the scenes from Africa. Maybe
Sudan, that would have been a year Europe, before Live Aid.
Maybe 83, whatever.
84, wasn't it, was the year in which we became aware of what was
And 85 was Live Aid then, wasn't it? Yeah. So it was 84, I was watching the news, and I remember hiding behind the couch, very fearful and traumatised by what I saw on the TV with the emaciated bodies and the starving children and the scenes from the famine-stricken countries of Sudan, Ethiopia and all that. And I remember just seeing that. It was on the news regularly, and all the campaigns were on, and I just remember being really traumatised. And as a seven-year-old, you're trying to process what's happening here or how is this happening, or... But it must have really triggered something in me. And the following year, Live Aid was on, but my dad won the captain's prize in golf in his local club, Gort. And at that stage, they had come to some kind of sweepstakes where he backed himself to win it. And there's a lot of members and he won. I think it was £800 or £1,800. Not sure the exact figure.
A lot of money.
A lot of money back in 84 and 85 when there was a recession as well.
Yeah.
And he had five children and he was a sales rep. We weren't a wealthy family. We were very, you know, mother didn't work. He decided to give every penny of that to Live Aid. So that must have had a huge... Your dad is your role model, your hero, I suppose, at that age. And seeing him give every penny of that to Live Aid, knowing that we probably needed it ourselves, and supported by my mother, obviously. They needed it more. That must have triggered something in me too, when the opportunity presented itself in 2005. Actually, 2 days ago, 20 years ago, I left... My first ever trip to Africa for 3 months as a volunteer physio was January 5th, 2005. So this time 20 years ago, I just boarded a plane. But I suppose, and I always say that, you know, we're so impressionable at that age. So little did he know that simple, unassuming act would result in me raising millions for the same cause 40 years later. And I suppose it really demonstrated to me the power of, you know, the incidents that happen in your childhood really shape how your adult life turn out, both positive and negative. And you can see the impact of, you know, violent parents, alcoholic parents, abusive behavior parents, dysfunctional families, etc., have on adults when they're older, and likewise for the positive. And that was a really positive. While it was traumatic, it was his actions were hugely inspirational to me and supported by my mother, you know, 30, 40 years later.
What prompted you to get on that flight 20 years ago? Because you still would have been having a really successful GA career. You had won a Football All-Ireland with Galway. That year, 2005, you'd also lose an All-Ireland final against Cork, the last final that Cork actually won. But what prompted you? Because when athletes are at a top level like that, and you were 28 and you had many years still potentially left ahead of you, they can be quite selfish and focused on what they have to do to get the maximum out of their career. So what prompted you to take time out to go for 3 months then?
Yeah, when I look back on it, the number of aspects contributed to that. So I'd just been off the back of, you know, in 2001 I played in both All-Irelands. I'd only took up football 6 months earlier, so I only took up football when I was 23.
What do you mean took it up? I mean took it up at senior inter-county level. You must have played it through underage.
No, so where I'm from is Clarenbridge, and it was all hurling at the time, so we'd no other sport. And South Galway and East Galway would hate football. Not hate it, but it would not play there.
Yeah.
They're not encouraged to play there. And I went to St Mary's, and I played in first year in St Mary's. That was it.
Where's St Mary's?
In Galway City.
Okay.
Great. Well, it's a co-ed school now, but it was a real kind of stronghold of sport, and particularly GAA in the city back in the day. It's sadly not the case anymore. So I went to St Mary's. I played first year with St Mary's, and Liam Salmon, the great Galway footballer, was a coach there. But I'm from Clarenbridge, and I was kind of starting to make going 14 teams at that stage. So my dad was coaching us, and the community, the other coaches. So I wasn't allowed to play football.
All hurling. And you, how did you manage to make the transition to football to end up on an inter-county?
Yeah, funny.
And win in All-Ireland.
Yeah, I was in UL. I applied to do physiotherapy in college, and that was huge points. I'd missed it by about 5 points. So I went to UL, and I was doing sports science. But my brother was applying the following year for his CEO. Yeah. And my mother said, just throw in it again there. You might never know, you might get physio. And 2 weeks into my second year in UL, I got offered physio in Trinity. So I transferred to Trinity. And as you know, Trinity is a great college. I loved it just down the road. Unbelievable 4 years there. But I suppose the hurling wasn't that strong there. So I played the hurling for the first 2 years there.
Yeah.
And we did well. We had a great group of players, but we weren't competitive. And I was started living with two Cavan guys who played under 21 and under minor for Cavan, and they were playing on the football team. So why don't you come out? I was playing actually soccer for Galway Town, Oscar Traynor at home, and Galway United were actually looking for me to go in, but the travel home was too much. Back then we'd no cars as students, and I contemplated that. I'd played Oscar Traynor for 2 years with Galway Town, and they had a really good setup in the football. I went out training just to keep fit for the winter. No intentions of really playing. And I ended up putting my corner back because I probably had no football, but I was fast and I was I could spoil guys. So anyway, I started to enjoy it. And then that was in third year. And in fourth year, they made me captain of the Sigerson. And I looked to join a club in Galway. And I approached a few clubs and I couldn't really join them because they had hurling clubs. So Saltill accepted me, not Nacara. And I joined them.
So to play football with them and to continue playing hurling with your own players.
Clarenbridge, yeah. Yeah, so I played football, championship for Galway before I played championship for Saltill. It's another interesting stat. So I was made captain of the Sigerson team in my final year in 2000, in September of 2000. And we went into 2001. We actually got to the quarter final of the Sigerson that year, but it was the first year there was no weekend because of foot and mouth. So anyway, So I got called in after the league final. Galway lost the league final to Mayo. I had a number of injuries. I got called in by John O'Mahony the week after. And I did 4 or 5 training sessions with them. And then I was named on the championship side to start against Leitrim in May. Caused a bit of controversy with a number of players kind of dropped out. But we got them all back and went on to win the All-Ireland. So I was very lucky.
What position did you play?
I played wing forward and corner forward. And it was John O'Mahony that took a punt to me. God rest him. He died this year. He was an unbelievable manager, an unbelievable leader, and I owe a lot to him because not many people would have plucked me in out of the blue, out of nowhere. Haven't played enough.
And how did you enjoy football compared to hurling?
I enjoyed the challenge. I always liked playing multiple sports, and I always wanted to play a lot of sports. I love sport. But it was very difficult to combine the two because Galway traditionally don't have dual players.
It's more of a Cork thing.
That's exactly. You do it well down there. But it wasn't really supported by the hurling side, and it was made very difficult. And
but you stayed on the hurling team throughout the year.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, we lost that. We lost the hurling final to Tipperary, and we won the football to Meath.
You could have been the 21st century Teddy McCarthy.
Yeah, close. It was close. It would have been a lovely. God rest Teddy as well. He's died. It would have been lovely to have done that. Because it's so hard, but it'll never be done now, I don't think, with the split season, but it would have been nice.
And when did you finish with the football? Did you just...
So that was coming back to my point. I'd done 3 or 4 years as dual.
Yeah.
And the hurlers really wanted me to give up the football, but I didn't. And then they kind of dropped me the year after, and then my brother pulled out, and then there was a bit of a row, a bit of a controversy, but we were brought back in again, and we were beaten by Clare. And I continued to do dual for 2 or 3 years, but it was very difficult. A lot of tug of war and trying to keep two panels happy,
yeah,
and then 2 managers happy, and I was worn out from that.
And working at the same time,
you know, I was in a long-term relationship that finished at 2004 as well. We'd lost a football county final in 2004. We'd been hammered by Kilkenny, I think Donegal beat us in the football, so I was just ready for just to get out of here, if you know what I mean, at that stage. So I approached Goal actually and a few others, but they had no real short-term vacancies. I wanted to go from September to Christmas and be back for the pre-season in January.
For the hurling.
And I don't think I'd given up the football at that stage, but I think I had. Yeah, I had. It just became too difficult emotionally.
But you were able to multitask clearly, though.
Yeah. So that's my problem, probably. I don't focus enough, and that's maybe why, you know, you don't go to the very top.
But then you couldn't get the placement in Africa that you wanted.
Yeah.
So how did you end up this time 20 years ago?
So I was in college in Trinity, and one of my groomsmen, Andy Farrell, lived in Blanchetown, or he played with St. Bridget's, and I became friendly with him through Trinity and be out and about in his place during the weekends or whatever. And I got to know, he was a teacher at this stage. I got to know Father Dan Joe O'Mahony. He's a Capuchin priest from Cork, great fella, unbelievable, ended up marrying me, but he's the chaplain in the Blanchetown Shopping Centre. And we were going to the London on the beer for a weekend away to a football match, and he was dropping us, a gang of 4 or 5 of us, and he said, "Are you going to Africa, Alan?" I said, "I'm not going now, Dan Joe." And he said, "Okay, leave with me." So he picked us up again on Monday morning. We flew back in, and he said, "Excuse, I don't want to be offensive, but," he said, "would you go to our lads in Zambia?" I mean, the Capuchins. And I didn't really want to go. I wanted to go with a group of young people with an agency because I wanted, you know, that kind of social network to be there. I didn't want to go maybe to be isolated in the middle of nowhere, maybe with older missionaries or whatever. That was just in my head. And he said, "Would you go to our guys?" And I said, "I will," in my own head, but I was thinking no. And then he said, "Would you work with AIDS and lepers?" Because they, would you believe, back then had a leprosarium in Zambia, and they did a huge amount of work with HIV because it was a huge problem back then. And still is, obviously, but a way bigger problem. And I said to him, I said, "Yes." But then I said, "Oh, gee, I don't know." And he said, "Look at Alan, there's an Irish nun that lives across from one of our guys in Mangu, Sister Cathy Crawford. She runs a home for disabled children and she's badly stuck for a physio. Will you go?" But she can only take you in January because this was November. They're closing in a couple of weeks for Christmas. And I said, "I will." And so I went for 3 months, January to March in 2005. And the rest is history, I suppose. Yeah, that experience really transformed.
Yeah, what was the experience like when you got there? Well, I mean, you'd seen the television pictures 20 years earlier as a child. I was reading, I think you had been at... I think a speech given by Archbishop Desmond Tutu in Galway.
Bob Geldof, yeah.
And which I think interested you again. And also, I think from what Tutu said, the benefits to you personally of giving, that you get an awful lot from that. I think any person gets a lot from it. And that goes back to what you were saying a little bit earlier.
Yeah, those words actually inspired me to go because I was just, this was in summer of 2004. and I was feeling sorry for myself with, you know, the hurling and the football and the relationship and life.
Yeah.
And I was feeling sorry for myself. And then we ended up working with a Down syndrome lady, maybe in her late 20s or 30s. Natalie was her name. And she got surgery in her hip and she couldn't walk. But we were working with her and working with her and working with her for weeks. And we didn't think we'd get there, but we eventually got her walking. And I suppose her smile and her joy lifted me totally out of my own self-pity and self-gloom that I was going through from weeks after all these different things. And just a week later, Tutu was in Galway getting an honorary doctorate or an award. And Geldof happened to be his introductory speaker. But Tutu spoke, and he spoke very simply. He's a very simple man. He spoke very, very simply. And he asked the audience a question, and he said, you know, hands up here who has helped people that they didn't have to help. And mostly put up their hands. And he asked, how did you feel after you did it? And he asked a number of people to contribute, and simply said, oh, I felt 10 foot tall after it. I felt glowing inside. I felt great about myself, whatever. And he said, exactly. He said, you know, it's physiologically proven that it helps others. It's really good for you physiologically, emotionally, psychologically. And he went through the research. And then he said, as human beings, why are we so stupid that we don't do an awful lot more of it if it's that good for us? So that then I said, right, I'm going. That was it. I was humming. I was kind of thinking, oh, I won't bother now. But then I said, okay, I'm going to look again and I'll go. And I went, and he was right.
And yet, were you prepared for what you found out there?
No, because when you watch on television, Matt, you can, and that's why most people don't get it, like a gas, and now you get fatigued to seeing it, you're shocked at the start, but you can turn the television and watch Liverpool and Man United last Sunday, or you can turn and watch I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out, whatever you watch, you can just turn and it's gone. But when you live there 24 hours a day for 3 months and you live and smell death and you see people dying, babies dying of hunger, and you see people coming to door, tapping the bellies, going hungry, 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 and you see, go to hospital and there's rats running up and down the wall, broken windows, and you see people getting surgery under with no anaesthetic, with no electricity, under a torch, or you go to the hospital and you smell that the electricity's failed and the for a few days in the heat and the morgue and the stench of death, and the, you know, that never leaves you. And so you live and breathe it, and then that's what really changed my outlook. And also, I suppose, I saw the unbelievable work that these two women were doing in their mid-60s, 70s. They were building houses, sinking wells, running home for disabled children, and nobody knew their story. And these were in their 70s, and I said, excuse the language, I said, what the F am I doing? Now, these are unbelievable Irish women who nobody know what they're doing. And what am I at? You know, they're dragging the communities by their hands and by their fingernails, and they're in there and they need help and they've no money and nobody knows the story. So I came home. I didn't have any intention of a charity at all. My intention was just to raise $5,000. So when I was there, actually, there was a drought and a famine, and we were feeding 800 families. And every month we'd give out 800 bags of 25 kg milled maize. And that would do each, and they'd walk away into the forest or into the bush with the bag on their head. And that would do that family maybe of 6 or 7 or 8 a meal every second day, and the last week they'd go hungry. We hadn't enough money to feed them. We hadn't enough, the cost of the food went way up because of the scarcity of it. So, and then I was working with the kids who were left the sand to die because of the disabled, really. And then there was disbelief that a lot of them had slits in their arms because letting out the evil spirits of the black doctor, black magic, and the, you know, black medicine. So it was really eye-opening. You know, nothing prepares you for that, really. And then, you know, they're still so happy and they're still so friendly and they're still singing and dancing. And that's one of the big lessons I learned coming back, and that's why maybe I played a lot better afterwards, was, you know, I asked Sister Kelly, how do they get through the day? And she said, I often ask that question, but watch them, they'll sing and they'll dance through the troubles. And if you can sing and dance through your troubles, you'll get through it a lot easier. But yeah, so it changed my value, looks, changed my outlook, it changed the course of my life. As I said, I only came back to raise $5,000 for a borehole. I asked the nun, how can I help? And she said, I'd love $5,000 for clean drinking water. If I can get $5,000, I'll drill down to the water table at 60 metres. We'll get it up. We'll help them grow their own food. I can't keep feeding them. We haven't got the money. So we need to get water. And if I get one whale, I know I'll get more. Then I'll get the Department of Agriculture and other agencies to help us with the seeds and the oxen and ploughs. And we'll teach them to grow their own food. That's what we have to do. And thankfully, one well led to 12 wells and led to, and we haven't given the money for food in 17, 16 years.
But then you decided to set up the charity.
Yeah.
Tell us a little
bit. That happened
3 years
later, really. So the Allen Care, I was raising money and gave it to her. And then it got so big that in 2008, I had to put a legal structure around it of a proper governance and a board of directors. And then I went full time, because it got so big, I went full time at it. And then the crash came. So I left my job in August, I think, 2008. And sure, in September, then Lehman's happened. So it was a challenging few years, because nobody wanted to give money to Africa at that stage. And a lot of people don't anyway. But I suppose because the need was so great in Ireland at the time, and all the charities here were massively slashed and massively.
But you came up with loads of really good ideas.
For
fundraising. You were highly imaginative. And in fairness, you got the GAA to buy in as well, didn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, they made Croke Park available to
it
you
did,
for
yeah.
various
fairness
functions.
Peter
and
McKenna,
stuff.
That was unbelievable. And we did analysis and we said, look, why do people give to charities, one charity over the other? And most people give to charity because they're emotionally connected to it. Like, I'm hugely emotionally connected to Temple Street now because they were so good to my son for 6 months.
And I will get to that.
Yeah,
well,
and I'm planning something big for them. But you're emotionally connected to it, so we'd come up with a way, or else they buy an experience that they really, really want. And it doesn't matter what the charity is, but they're buying that experience, like to play in Croke Park, you know, because that's their lifelong dream.
Yeah.
And they've been, because they never got to do that. So we created kind of unique experiences for people to fulfill their lifelong dreams. And they got a huge experience for it. But it was a win-win, but we also got to make huge impact with the funding that they gave. And I also said, during that period, I said, look at the experience I got in Africa really changed my style as a leader, or my style as an individual, my values and my priorities. And so I'd love to give that to companies and organisations. So we created a leadership programme whereby, you know, we brought 10 or 12 or 15 leaders from different companies. They paid the 10 grand and they came out to Africa. They were stripped back. They were exposed to what I'd seen. And in that kind of strip back, something really powerful about the African sand and the red soil, and it just strips you back, and the purity of the people and the purity of the children and the rawness of it, and just strip right back. And we brought performance coaches out with us. And then I trained, that's why I got into this. I trained up to deliver some of these workshops myself. And we had great success in that. And people were paying, you know, for a leadership program, not to support a charity, if you know what I mean. So we had to, and then those companies became emotionally connected to the work we did, so they continued to support us because they saw the great work that was being done, or continued to support the nuns that were doing the work out there at the time. So yeah, it was you have to become, you know, you have to inspire people really to get involved. And
but tell us then about all the players that you got involved.
Yeah.
Because at this stage, there are hundreds of GAA players who have travelled to Africa with you and stuff. So what sort of reaction did you get around the country, and what sort of people got involved with you in the GAA?
Yeah, Don Lowe came out a lot. He brought a whole crew from Klein then. Back in the day, Declan Meehan's, he had Brian Carroll. And then recently, of the likes of Damien Comer, Aidan O'Shea's, Grace Walsh's, Caroline O'Hanlon's, about eight of the Cork Camogie team, you know. You've had some of the Dubs. Michael Dara has been out, brilliant fella, brilliant social conscience, you know, as you know well, from around Dublin City, and now with Sanctuary Runners. Conor Myler, as loads of the Antrim players have been coming at Neil McMahon, as great people. And, you know, part of that is also a leadership program for them where they now have realised they've become change makers. So we really encourage out there that they continue on becoming that change maker. If it's back in their school, if it's back in their community, if it's back in their team, that they can really continue that active citizenship and bring the experience back to benefit their own communities, their own teams, their own schools and their own communities.
It's arguably less important, but it's still relevant, I want to bring up with you, because you probably did end up ending your own GAA career prematurely because of it at inter-county level. And it did strike me that you once said that there was a particular manager who said that you were too distracted from your GAA commitments. And that struck me. My God, the GAA is an amateur organisation. And it's for the better, which make people better.
Yeah.
And you were becoming better from what you were doing in Africa. And then that was regarded as being an impediment to your contribution to your Gaelic or to your hurling team.
Yeah. It was probably just a perception that was out there, you know, that maybe I didn't take it as serious because I was travelling a little bit with it. I was working in the hospital at the time. I was also doing the charity. I was also playing football with the club. So, like you said earlier, maybe just too much multitasking going on. That was a perception of that current setup.
That's just you.
That's just.
That's what gets the best.
And then, you know, fast forward 3 years later and I was playing the best hurling of my life. We won the Club of Ireland with Clarence Bridge. I was brought back in. I was asked to come back in after a two-year absence, and same management set up said, well, you'll have to go up to the charity. And I said, well, you know, it's my full-time job now. That's what I do full-time. So we came to an agreement that I would come back in, and I played that year. I started again. And I'm a firm believer that the experience made me a lot better player, because you played with freedom now. You know, our main aim was, a lot of the children we worked with were the same dreams that I'd have or you'd have, to play, become a broadcaster, to become a sports star, to become an author, to become a TV presenter, to become a physio, to become whatever they wanted. But they have no chance by pure fluke of where you're born, of where they're born. But we have every chance. And I think that's what a lot of the GAA players get when they come back. And a lot of the players have played a lot better since they've come back recently, because they've played with that freedom and they've realised that you've got to take your opportunity, because you're lucky to have that opportunity. And that's the penny dropping moment for a lot of the players, that these kids have no chance by pure fluke of where they were born. And why were they born there and I was born here? Galway or Cork or Mayo. And a lot of the players have come back, and we've encouraged them to come back and play. Because if you know when you play sport or do anything or do a show, or the shows you do best is the shows you really enjoy. So when you play with a smile and play with freedom and play with enjoyment, you play a lot better. And that's what I tried to do when I came back. And when I did that, I played an awful lot better in my performance, because it wasn't about me. You know, and I remember I brought a group to India once, to an ashram. We were funding a project in India. This guy was an addiction centre, and we built loads of ashrams and loads of huts for him, and a centre for people who were drinking in the mountains, in the hills. And he was big into yoga. And there were seven stages of yoga. The exercise, the asanas are just one thing, but there's a thing called karma yoga, and where we had to clean the toilets, or basically everything you do, he said, karma yoga's philosophy is everything you do should be for the benefit of others. And I went up to him and said, that's wonderful, how about sport? I play high level sport, and you know, how did that work? And he said, how's it worked for you so far? I said, oh, hit and miss. And I said, how do I do it when I go home? And this is about 2010. And he said, play to bring a smile to the people in the crowd. Play to bring enjoyment to the sick people in your village. Because when you connect to something bigger than yourself, it's not about you anymore. It frees you up. And he said, you'll go to places you'll never go to. And that's what happened with Clarence Bridge in 2011. I just played for my brother, I played for my dad, I played for the sick people in the village, and I played with a smile, and I played to bring enjoyment to the people who are watching. So it wasn't about me getting a man of the match or getting scores where I tighten up and be nervous. And because when it comes all about you, you retract. But when you're connected to something bigger than yourself, you're freed up to express yourself, and you go to places you've never done before. And I had the best year I ever had at my club. So I think there's a great learning in that for people.
What was more important to you, club or county?
Oh, club. I suppose when I was growing up and I was playing with the two, I was so engrossed in county, I probably wasn't the greatest club player. And I didn't really do the club justice until maybe 2011, when we won, 2010, 2009. Now, we won our first county in 2001, and I did well that year. But I probably wasn't the leader I should have been, or the team player I should have been, because I was so much going on with Africa, with Salt Hill, won a club at Ireland with Salt Hill as well. Lucky that we won that as well. And
you've got a set of medals very few players in GAA have.
I was lucky. Like, even the Giants Salt Hill, to win it. If you told me in 1999 or 2000 that I would have a football All-Ireland with Galway and a club All-Ireland with Saltill before everyone a senior hurling medal, I'd have said you're off your head. But that's what happened.
And then you won your senior All-Ireland with Clarenbridge.
Yeah, I won your senior All-Ireland with Clarenbridge.
The only thing missing was your senior All-Ireland with Galway.
Last two finals, yeah. Tip beat was in 2001 in Cork in 2005. But I probably wasn't the club player I should have been for Clarenbridge until the very end. And then Micheál Dunne came on board, the current Galway manager, and he really challenged me. He said, you know, to be step up and to be a real leader. And it was his kind of challenge, I suppose, and constantly on you to raise your standards that really inspired me or challenged me to become the player I did become for the club that year and the leader. And he did that for all the other key leaders as well, but particularly I needed to do it.
When you stop playing competitive sport, how much did you miss it?
Hugely. And then I tried to, you know, you try to do other things like golf and play competitive golf and play other stuff. I was lucky that my transition wasn't as, some people find it very hard to transition, but I suppose I was lucky that I had such a passion in Africa and other sports that it was easier for me. And it wasn't, hurling and football wasn't my identity. Africa was nearly more my identity at that stage and the charity. So I had that sense of purpose, I suppose, that could replace it. And a lot of people struggle with that because they don't have that sense of purpose when they retire. And I try and help the GPA with that through a transition program where you try and connect players with something that's...
Yeah, because you have a business now as well.
Yeah.
As well as doing all the charitable work.
Yeah, I do, yeah.
Which is sort of related to this in the sense of getting the most out of people.
Yeah, it's about... Yeah, it's kind of leadership development, people development, adapting coaching styles of leadership, kind of effective communications, you know, creating client events. And I suppose the main ethos about it is I'm a big believer. I've been exposed to a lot of leaders over my life and, you know, very few really, really great ones. And the ones that were really great for me, and Simon Sinek would say, are the people who, you know, a lot of people are promoted to a leadership role or are promoted to a management role because they're good at what they do.
Not because they're necessarily going to be good managers.
Yes, and they fail to make the transition that it's not their job to do the job now. Their main job is to take care of, support and develop those responsible for doing the job now. And a lot of average managers will just see you as a piece of meat or me as a piece of meat to get to the bottom line, whereby the great ones really, they make you feel that they genuinely care about you. They care about your development as a professional, but also they care about you when the shit hits the fan at home, excuse the language, when challenges come at home and they look after you. And you go through a brick wall for those. And people are talking about talent management and talent retention now. That's the greatest thing you can do to retain talent, is to make your staff and your people feel that the greatest human need is to feel loved, valued and belonged. And most managers don't make you feel that way. And everyone needs to be treated separately and everybody's different and everyone's wired differently. And a lot of the average managers would just treat everybody generically, where the great ones treat lead situationally, you know, and they, you know, they have great that emotional intelligence and relationships. And we're a big believer that leadership is a relationship through which you influence the actions and behaviours of others. So the key word is relationships. And they really focus on developing really strong relationships. So the stronger the relationship, the more the influence on their actions and behaviours. And also, it builds loyalty, huge loyalty. And like you go to a big wall for a manager like that or a leader, you know.
Come back to me about Temple Street.
Yeah.
Because I know this is very important to you because of the illness that your son, Ruan, is it?
Ruan, yeah.
That he suffered when he was a baby, an infant.
Yeah, yeah. So,
I mean, this was very, very serious.
Oh, hugely serious, yeah. It was touch and go for a long time. And, you know, with high-performing teams, Temple Street were amazing. And
tell us a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit what happened with him?
So, yeah, so he was due on the 17th of December, but he actually was born on our wedding anniversary on the 14th of December.
What year was it?
2015. And so his birthday was just there recently. Just turned 9 now, thanks be to God. But the first day he was fine. Second day then I went away for a few hours and Kira's mother and sister came in to visit her and I came back and I noticed that I was gone for a few hours. So I noticed that he'd been sleeping or hadn't fed from maybe 12 to 6, which is unusual. And he was kind of drowsy.
It wasn't your first child, was he?
It was the first.
It was,
yeah.
A couple of girls as well now, don't you?
No, I have two boys and one girl. So Ben has come next and then Fia after that. Okay. So I have two boys and a girl, yeah. So they're all good, thanks be to God. And
but anyway, you came back and noticed he hadn't fed.
Yeah, and then I was leaving around 8 to go home because he couldn't stay in. And he still hadn't fed and he was still asleep. And there was a younger nurse on it. She said, oh, isn't it great? But I just had an inkling going out the door, go right, go home, and go left, go up to the nurse's station. They changed shift. And I went up to the nurse's station. I said to this older nurse, I said, you know, this is such, is this normal? I thought they were supposed to be born for food every 3 hours or whatever. She said, what? She ran down and checked him, and he was lethargic and flaccid or whatever. But she checked his blood sugars, and they were 0.4. They're supposed to be between 4 and 6. So this kid needs to go to intensive care straight away. So he was rushed up to intensive care, and then they monitored him. So his insulin was unstable. So they thought it was a so at some stages, this can be transitionary. So when the mother's placenta is removed, they're dependent on that for the sugar and insulin. But in some instances, it takes them maybe a week maybe to get used to their own, regulate their own body, blood sugars. But after a week, then they said, no, he's to go. He's severe illness called congenital hyperinsulinemia, which means he's producing too much insulin, his blood sugars are hugely unstable, and they're going really low, which is very dangerous for his brain. And he's had a number of bleeds already on his brain, so we need to get him to Temple Street. And we were transferred to Temple Street for the day before Christmas Eve, and we spent there all through Christmas, all through New Year and into January, and they're trying 2 or 3 different medications that work with most children, but that wasn't working. So they took a scan. And the scan then said, look, it's more likely, they need to go to UK, Manchester, for a scan and potentially surgery. So we were flown to Manchester in February. They did the scan, and there's 2 types of the illness. One is which affects all your pancreas, which is called diffuse, or one which is a little lesion or a tumour. It's called focal. So our genetic testing said it should be focal, but when they did the scan, it said it was diffuse, which is devastating because they needed them to go in and remove 95% of the pancreas. So that happened on the 26th of February. We went down and we handed him away. And you just, you know, when you hand away your child, you just sign it. You know, he could die from the anaesthetic and all these complications. So you hand him off at 3 months, and he went down for surgery. And said, look, stay close because we may need to ring you in, blah, blah, blah. So we went down for breakfast in Manchester, then at the hospital, and 2 hours later, he said to us, like, this doctor, he said, you got to get up here quick. And I said, is he okay? Is he alive? And blah, blah, blah. He said, you got to get up here. So we got up there. I meet you at the top of the stairs in the children's hospital. So up to the top of the stairs, he said, come on, we need to get you in and sit down. And I was kind of shaking. Is he alive? He's alive. Because he wouldn't tell me. And the next thing is he waited, and we'd wait for a code and for this room to sit down, and we're waiting, and I was expecting the worst. And I saw his inter, his SHO coming in behind him, kind of smiling. I said, this doesn't fit. And he sat down and he said, you're not going to believe this. When we opened him up, it's focal. It's only a tiny lesion. We're going to take out 3%. So it's a miracle, he said. I don't know how it happened. And I said, my first words were, excuse the language, I said, remind me never to play poker with you, yeah. but we were over the moon. We got an absolute miracle, and we stayed another 6-7 weeks there. Back to Temple Street for another month or two, and then we got home. And yeah, he had a number of incidences and a number of issues for a couple of years, but he's doing well now, and we got a miracle.
How did you feel through all of that? How did you and Ciara cope with that? Because was there ever a part where you thought, Jesus, I've gone off and I've been helping people and all the rest of it. Yeah. Why me? Why has this happened to us? You know, what do we do to deserve this?
Yeah. Yeah, that did cross my mind several times. But I have a great faith, and I kind of had an inner instinct that it was going to work out some way. And there's a reason for all this. There was, you know, there's some reason we're going through this. Because you have to frame it that way. And we then decided that, look, we were helpless, we couldn't do anything. We just had to put our faith and trust in the doctors, and faith and trust in whatever you believe in out there. And I kind of just a few really strange instances that just kind of hard to explain that I knew was going to work out. And we decided then and there, we said, look, we can't do anything. We can just be, all we can do now is just be loving parents and just try and give them as much love and as much energy and as much healing energy or whatever you could do positive, and make it as seamless as possible, because he was going through a lot of trauma. Every hour, half hour, there's a pricky seed, which is sore for a baby, and then squeeze blood from his little feet. And then the sugars were never right, and you're waiting for the numbers, and then the numbers are bad. It's not working. And so it was constant. It was constant and negatives until the very end. It was constant bad results or bad news until the last, where we got good, the real good news, where we never expected. So it was amazing. And I was just
the elation of that.
Oh, the elation was unbelievable. And, you know, during those 3 months, I just trained up on healing and different energies and different things. And I used to be constantly doing that now. I don't know if it made any difference, but that's all I could do. All I could do was try and be positive and try and bring what I could.
It's a test of you, isn't it? It's also a test of a relationship.
It's hugely. Yeah, we're very lucky that, you know, Kira, I suppose I met Kira before. I went just before. I used to play football with her brother, Finian Hanley. He was fullback for Galway for years on Saltill. And her mother was a saint, and she would help me a lot with the charity. And then I got to become very good friends with Kira first. So we were friends for a year or two first, and became really close friends. And then it naturally morphed into a relationship. So I think that kind of friendship and that, you know, kind of soulmate kind of stuff it was huge to test, but it made us a lot stronger. And we were lucky that, and in some cases it wouldn't, but we were just lucky that, I suppose, you're lucky to meet the right person that you go to life with, you know. I think that's one of the biggest decisions you make, is who you marry, isn't it, or who you choose to partner with, maybe is a better word now. But we've been very lucky, because we have had a lot of challenges. Her dad died very suddenly in 2013, and then her brother died very suddenly 18 months ago, young, 35. So, you know, we've had a lot of challenges, but we've got through them all very well. And that was a huge challenge as well with Ruan, because we didn't know whether he was going to live or die, and it was touch and go up until even during that surgery. So,
well, I think given everything you've done for others, you deserved that bit of good fortune.
There was thousands praying for him in Africa anyway, I was told by the nuns and the different priests out there, you know. So that, I think it all helps in some way, you know.
What's the future for you now? I mean, how long will you continue? Is this a lifelong thing, you think, that you'll be helping Africa?
Yeah, you know,
maybe that sounds wrong, but assisting rather
yeah,
than helping.
Assisting,
assisting or, a better or, word than helping.
Assisting or maybe partnering.
Okay, even better,
partnering,
yeah.
Yeah, or support, trying to give a hand up rather than a hand out. I suppose my big passion is that, I think Warriors for Humanity. So, not everyone wants to go to Africa. So,
yeah. So, what is Warriors for Humanity?
So, Warriors for Humanity, as I said, I'm a big believer that most people want to make a difference and want to leave a positive legacy. But a lot of people are connected to different charities through their emotional connection or their personal experiences, and they don't know how to leave a legacy, or they don't know how to get involved. So we're hoping to create many, many experiences going forward where people can come on board and leave a positive legacy in their local communities, to war-torn regions, Gaza, whatever it is. But that's the ultimate vision. That'll be a global citizen movement whereby people can come together and, you know, create events and leave. And we support them through this platform, that they can make a positive impact and leave a positive legacy in whatever cause that's closest to their heart, or whatever cause that they would like to get involved in, not just Africa. So my aim is to spread it for. And I've loads of big ideas, from Legacy Forest to Gardens of Unity to, like, we built a Garden of Unity towards Indian nun in Zambia, where there's tribal areas, and this garden is a place for non-religion, where people from all tribes come, and they did activities, and it was a beautiful place, and it brought communities together. I think there's a great need maybe for Gardens of Unity in all cities of the world. What we see now with migration and the polarization of people, I suppose, you know, where people are, there's a huge divide, and there's a huge disconnect with people from different nationalities and different causes. There's a huge perceived threat from incoming, I suppose, refugees and asylum seekers, etc. I think the government could handle it a lot better, where it could be a lot more structured and a lot more planned. So there's a number of projects like that. Even the peace games, with the idea of where you bring the Plant the Planet games to peace games into war-torn regions. So there's a number of big ideas. I'd love to get. They may never get off the ground, but we'll keep trying anyway, I think, and we'll keep trying to fight the good fight, let's just say.
You've lots of energy, haven't you?
Oh, I don't know about that. I'm waning now as I get older, and you have three kids, and I got a bad flu over Christmas, so I don't know how I am. But yeah, no, I think when you have the great saying that, and I think it's true, is, you know, the most powerful weapon on earth is the human soul on fire. So if you can catch fire on something you're really passionate about, I think it doesn't become a chore. It doesn't drain you as much, or you have more energy for it, because it's a passion rather than a job.
Alan Kearns, it has been great talking to you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it.
And our thanks again to Alan Kearns for joining us today, and our thanks to our series partner, Close Brothers Motor Finance, rated excellent on Trustpilot for customer service, and Portal Close Connect means it can say yes more often, approve finance applications in minutes and sometimes seconds. So if you're looking to be a partner, reach out to the motor finance people at Close Motor Finance. So that's it for today's Magnified. Hope that you enjoyed this. All of the others on the series that you can go back and check out. There's loads more there if you haven't heard of them before, and we'll have loads more in the weeks to come as well. So until the next time, from me, Matt Cooper, thank you very much for joining us.
Magnified with Matt Cooper, proudly sponsored by Close Brothers Motor Finance. With Close Connect, our technology means we can say yes more often. Approve finance applications in minutes and sometimes seconds. Partner with Close Brothers Motor Finance at closemotorfinance.ie.
Go loud. Sounds better with us.